You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Before I introduce our speakers, I first want to say how grateful I am to each of them, not only for their willingness to share today, but to do so with such enthusiasm. No arms were twisted in the assembling of this August gathering. And secondly, I want to acknowledge what a privilege it is for me to be a part of a community like the Fountains, where I get to walk alongside not just our speakers this morning, but among a whole community of folks who are not just willing, but eager to think deeply and honestly about the spiritual journeys on which we find ourselves. Our first speaker is Herb Puryear. Herb was raised in Lubbock, Texas, educated at Baylor University, Stanford University, and earned his PhD from the University of North Carolina, all of which means he's spent a lifetime asking very good questions and refusing pat answers. He taught at Trinity University in San Antonio, maintained a private psychology practice, has led workshops and conferences, and for more than 40 years, from 1983 to 2024, served as the founder and director of the Logos Center, a Jesus-based meditation center here in Scottsdale. Herb brings a lifetime of rigorous scholarship, spiritual practice, and deep reflection to his journey. And don't forget to ask him about the time he got to hang out with the Dalai Lama. You'll also be hearing from Donna Brinkmeyer. Donna is a retired educator from Vermont whose career took her all over New England as a teacher, counselor, curriculum director, administrator, and teacher trainer. Her particular passion was designing programs for highly able students, helping people learn how to think, not just what to think. After spending 5 years living full-time in an RV, Donna and her husband Lance settled here in Fountain Hills, though they still spend about half of every year on the road. Her most recent adventure took her trekking and traveling through Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan. A direct descendant of the Puritan preacher Jonathan Edwards, Donna was raised firmly within traditional Christianity. Over time, her faith has widened and deepened. She now finds meaning and vitality committed to interfaith efforts that value respect, humility, and shared humanity. And finally, you'll hear from Gerald Kane. Gerald was raised a devout Catholic in the San Francisco Bay Area and attended St. Ignatius Prep, an all-boys Jesuit high school. He studied engineering at UC Berkeley, a path he set aside after graduation to join the leadership of an evangelical Christian ministry. Today, Gerald runs a real estate recruiting firm from his office in Gilbert. He's been married to his wife Leslie for 28 years, is the father of two teenagers, and is the devoted companion of a 4-year-old Labradoodle named Django. Gerald describes himself as a confirmed skeptic and introvert. He is an avid reader, writer, documentary watcher, and admits to loving ideas more than people. In every Bible study he's ever been a part of, he's been described as the annoying questioner, a label he's beginning to embrace, not as a diss, but as a spiritual discipline. We welcome Herb, Donna, and Gerald as they share their stories of curiosity, courage, and how they've changed their minds.
Our words of wisdom are selections from Romans chapter 12, verse 2.
Do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewing of the mind, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
I owe you all an apology, because I had always thought of Methodists as vanilla and pedestrian. And the big change, what really changed my mind recently is the Fountains and David. I've had maybe 20 ministers, and he's at the top. And I've just, the thrill of my week is to be able to come here. I've always enjoyed going to church, but the Fountains has been wonderful for me for many ways. The four pillars of the teaching here, we put love first, and the caring for just the, not so much believing in Jesus, but trying to do what he commanded us to do. And the fellowship that we have with our fellow believers in other faiths, the congenial fellowship that we share with those of other faiths, and then inclusivity. So to me, this is the most solid foundation of what we're about, of any statement that I've heard. And so this has been a big change for me in my life. One of the big changes, you remember a movie called Lost Horizons, mm-hmm. with Shangri-La and the Tibetan, and somehow that movie just thrilled me and made me zealous. I was eager to study mysticism, and over the decades, I've done a great deal of that and reading about the mysticisms of the world. And one of the things, you know, I grew up Southern Baptist, and I was pretty committed to that. In 1962, I was in San Antonio and heard on the radio that the Southern Baptist Convention had passed two resolutions, one, never to have a Catholic president, and other, never to integrate. And I was horrified. I was just so dismayed and quickly shedding all the shackles of Southern Baptist that I could, and freeing myself of those limitations.
I wrote mine down so I wouldn't go over the time limit. And by the way, I challenge you all to go home and answer this question yourself. It was a wonderful exercise, David. I'm very pleased that you asked me to do this, not only to think about in what ways you have changed your thinking, but how you got there. So I challenge you all to do that. I was born into a family of faith, faith in God, faith in America, faith in the Chicago Cubs. And let me tell you, over the years, keeping faith in the Chicago Cubs has been the toughest. I did Sunday school, church, vacation Bible school, youth fellowship, choir, all of those things that you did. And though I was born, baptized, confirmed, and later married as a Presbyterian, when I was about 16, there was a Methodist revival in our town. And as most of the kids in my youth group were, we were all saved and born again. And I lived those beliefs and those tenets for many, many decades. But there were always questions niggling at the back of my mind, and three in particular. The first one was that if the Bible is inerrant and infallible, why does it contradict itself? Even before I heard David's sermons, I'm going, now listen, there are at least two creation narratives. There's multiple birth and crucifixion narratives. And then for me, as a female in the 70s, the woman issue. Because 1 Corinthians 14:34 says that women should remain silent in the churches. 1 Timothy 2:12 says that women are not permitted to teach men or be an authority over men. But in Romans 16, Paul tells the entire congregation to do whatever Phoebe, a woman, tells them to do. As well, he praises a woman named Priscilla for teaching both him and another man, particularly by name, Apollos. And that niggled. That really niggled. Another question was, if God is all loving as I was taught, how can he kill 250,000 people in a tsunami? Remember that year, that December, it was right around Christmas time, 2002, something like that? That was a tough one. For that matter, how can he condemn the vast majority of the human race to hell for not accepting Jesus as their Savior? And the standard answers, some things you just have to accept on faith, or you'll understand in time, just didn't cut it with me. Because if God is perfect, as I was taught, his logic should be perfect. And while Scripture commanded me to love God with my whole heart, my whole body, and my whole mind, when I used my mind, it didn't work. It just didn't work. My final question was, if God is all just, as I was taught, why did he bless me by sparing my house in a tornado, but not the guy living next to me? Certainly, he was just as good and deserving as being blessed as I was, and yet I was blessed, and he weren't. And if God was all-powerful, he could have saved their houses too. If God were just, he would have saved their houses too. And if God was all-loving, he would have saved their houses too. So again, the logic of it just didn't line up for me. And the conflict between what the church was teaching me and what reality presented created a continual tension in my spiritual life. Then I came to the fountains. So when I started coming here 14 years ago, I was ripe for discovery. I took the Living the Questions course, talked with other seekers. My questions were respected. My skepticism was accepted. And my doubts laid open to intellectual scrutiny. And though I am not the esoteric reader that I think David and Herb and Gerald are, I did find three books that helped me a lot for ordinary people like me. The first one was Misquoting Jesus, which talks about the infallibility and the inerrancy of the Bible. You cannot read this book and still think that that Bible is factual history. You learn how that Bible was written. 10,000 people had their fingers on it, most of them men. And you just, that question is gone. Next question, when bad things happen to good people, which got at the whole issue of, you know, why their houses were knocked out, but mine wasn't. God cannot be all just, all powerful, and all loving. It just doesn't work. And the third one by Brian McLaren. Why did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad cross the road? And it's not the beginning of a bad joke. I tell you, it's not. It sounds like it. But this one really showed me how to live my faith in a multi-faith world. Because our religion, well, let me not go too far off script here. The most challenging part of making these changes was giving up beliefs that I held very deeply, but I didn't have anything to replace them with. I remember my first Christmas of doubt. It was a soul-sucking year, let me tell you. I'd look at the nativity, I'd listen to the Messiah, and it was just empty. It was like, if this isn't real, what is it? But over time, I did learn that by being intellectually honest with myself and being surrounded by a community here at the Fountains, that I could make that journey and find new answers. I'm still on that journey. I hope I always will be. I've developed a much broader concept of who God is, or the divine, or the creative spirit, whatever aphorism you want to use. and much more expansive thoughts about what prayer can be. Prayer was really hard because I always went to bed at night praying, and now what do I do? Who am I talking to? What do I expect to have happen? So that was a time for me. Many of my former church colleagues consider me an atheist. I think my brother and sister probably think I'm going to hell. But I now embrace a spirituality that transcends the limits of the God of Abraham. And that spirituality is delighting me more and more every day. Thank you.
So when I think about my journey, I would probably separate it into stages. I grew up Catholic, and so for the first 20 years of my life, very heavily Catholic. My grandfather immigrated from Puerto Rico in the 20s. So that sort of explains the Catholicism. My mother, maybe an eighth or a 16th black, but you know, in Mississippi, where she was raised, that's enough. You're colored. So she, in her mind, she identified as black, and so married my dad. And you know, we always grew up like, "What are you, Mom? You're like..." She's like, "I'm black." We're like, "No, you're not. I'm black." But that sort of explains my Catholic upbringing. She was one of eight. Her sister became a nun. Her younger brother became a priest in the Catholic Church, then a bishop, and he became the first black archbishop in the United States. So he was quite something in the 80s, and whenever he would come visit our church as a little kid growing up, I'd get to see my uncle, you know, dressed in regal attire and a crown and a staff and people kissing his ring and, you know... And I'm like, "Wow, Uncle Gene is famous. Look at this. This is amazing." Like I mentioned, I was brought up in Catholic schools. And then when I went to college, I joined an evangelical fundamentalist Christian church / cult, if I'm being honest. But It was life-changing at the time. It was a community. It was a bunch of kids that learned the Bible. I remember showing up, and the preacher would get up and go, "Turn your Bibles to Ephesians," and everyone whipped out their own personal Bibles. I'm like, "What?" And they could flip through the book and turn to Corinthians, and they would flip. I'm like, "This is amazing. How are you guys doing this?" And they would have classes. They had a first principles class, which was, you know, eight studies, and they would teach you to memorize the scriptures. And, you know, another word for that might be, here are all the reasons we're right and everyone else is wrong, and how to show them from the Bible that they're wrong and we're right. So, of course, I became fluent in that and memorized all the studies of seeking God and Jesus. And it made me feel, at the time, okay, I didn't learn this in the Catholic Church. We never read the Bible. I just went through rituals. But now I'm learning the truth. I'm learning the Bible, and I'm reading it, and this is amazing. And like you said, there are the little things that tug at you, that weren't making sense. They niggled. But I was raised, so that was the next 20 years of thinking, well, yeah, the Bible is the literal word of God, and we've got to follow it, and we've got to, and why isn't everyone else doing it? And so it was easy for me to conflate prejudice and arrogance with humility and obedience. I'm not prejudiced against gay people. I'm humble and following the Bible. I don't want to be, but God clearly calls me to think this way. So that's what I'm doing. And so for 20 years, you know, I had best friends. I met my wife there. And I learned a lot about humility, confessing sin, having a conscience. And I would say probably two things that really pushed me out. I mean, there were the little niggling things like, okay, you know, the disciples follow Jesus, they fall asleep, and then we have his prayer. How does anyone know what he prayed if everyone was asleep? That makes no sense. And then I would put that to the back of my mind. And then 9/11 came, and it was the year 2000, and I remember 2001, and everyone in America was talking about Islam and Christianity and the East versus West, and their religion is violent. Have you read their Quran? And I'm going, have you read our Bible? That's not. And so it really got me angry and frustrated that everyone was talking about how bad this one religion was. And no, you have to read it. Their religion actually says to kill infidels. And their religion, and I'm like, so that really bothered me. And I remember going to church and the preacher saying, you know, we got to read our Bibles. I've never read the Bible and regretted reading it and thinking, oh, I wish I had never read that. And the church laughed. And I thought, I have. I did this morning. I was disgusted with some of the things I was reading. And slowly but surely, I was getting discouraged with what we were doing as a church, and I found that book, Misquoting Jesus. Oh, yes. I found it in a library. Because I was like, we need to do more than just these rote devotionals. I found Misquoting Jesus by Bart Ehrman. And yeah, maybe that's, and it frightened me. I will say, for me, growth is like grief. It does not feel good. You're unlearning. You're lost. You're turning your back. You're betraying your community. And I read that, and I felt like, okay, so. And I didn't trust Bart because he's an agnostic. I'm like, I'm going to lose my faith, and I'm going to be like him, and I'm going to lose everything. But what he's saying about the Bible is music to my ears. It's like, finally, someone's making sense of what this book actually is, but I don't want to become like him. And I kept reading, and I found scholars like John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Borg and Elaine Pagels. And I would go to the websites, and their teachers or professors, you could just email them. You could find them on the website, and they would email back the same day. And I was like, oh my gosh. I'm like, Bart, da 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 da. And Elaine, and they would say, yeah. So I said, how do I keep my faith? And I don't want to let go of God, but I've got to let go of this kindergarten level thinking. Find an open and affirming church. And I was like, I don't know what that means. So I Googled it, and I think that was the thread. I honestly think that the gay issue was what pushed me over the edge, because it was, hey, there are people that take the Bible seriously, but not literally. That's what I want. So in order to find that, I've got to find a church where there's a lot of gay people. And that way I'll know. That will be sort of the, that will be the litmus test, yeah, of if this is the kind of church that I want to belong to. And that was 10 years of unlearning, reading videos, Jack Shelby Spung, you know, looking for something like that. And that's where I found Living the Questions, which would eventually lead me here. I never came here, but I found the Living the Questions, and I ordered it, and I just went through it myself. And I one day I came to a church which I felt like was amazing. It was called The Wells, and there were gay people and young people, and I'm like, this is it. I've arrived. I think I'm where I am supposed to be. And I think God had one more part of my heart he needed to expose, because I brought my friends and family. I was like, I found this amazing church. And they've got this great musician, this lesbian couple, Angie. She's got purple hair, and her wife, and it's perfect for us. And I brought my family, and this is where I knew it's where I needed to be, because the minister stood up and he goes, I have an announcement. This is my last day. And my wife and I are moving, and your new minister is Angie and her wife. And I remember going, uh-oh. Uh-oh. And it was a double uh-oh, because it was like, uh-oh. And then I saw my prejudice. I was like, uh-oh. Like, you will worship with a gay person, but will you let a gay person lead you spiritually? Will you let them? And I remember crying. I remember sitting there just going, I can tell this is where I'm supposed to go. I can tell this is right. But I felt like the rich young ruler. I felt like, yeah, I was patting myself on the back. Like, yes, Jesus, I've obeyed. I've done all this. It's like, great. Give everything you have to the poor, and she'll be your minister. And I was walking away sad. Like, I wasn't ready for that. On reflection, it was that I didn't have the courage to embrace publicly. I think that's what it was. I told my old church, I'm leaving. I don't believe this. I don't know where I'm going, but I don't think we have it. It was fine for me to embrace my gay brothers and sisters. We worship together. But I could not hide. Yeah, this is my, like, the minister. Come and I was like, okay, so I have to embrace publicly. That's what affirming is. I cannot be afraid of what my old church and my old friends think of me. I'm just, it's cowardice. It's not, it's prejudice and it's cowardice. And I think the cowardice was the thing that scared me the most to look at. So anyway, I found Living the Questions. I just Googled it one day. I was like, I'm going to go to that church. And I walked in here and I saw all of you and I thought, nope, this is not the place for me at all. And then I walked to the back table and I saw all the books. And I was like, oh, they're just like me. They are. And so I was like, yeah. And I saw the, and I listened to Dave and I saw the maze. I was like, these are my people. Yeah. So that's kind of how I wound up here.
We all three read this book, and it affected our thinking.
So. And let me say that Bart Ehrman came out of a fundamentalist evangelical background, which you all can relate to. And it took clawing your way out of that to be where you are right now. And incidentally, I just saw Bart Ehrman just retired from his teaching gig, and he's got a video on YouTube. All of you should go watch it. It's The Last Lecture, it's called. And he kind of summarizes his whole career of teaching. And so since he was important to all of you, I would recommend that to you. But why don't you say a little bit more about maybe one thing that you could share with everybody that from any faith tradition or from any spiritual discipline that has been helpful to you, just broadly speaking, a discipline or a way of thinking or of approaching things. You've all talked about the niggle, right? I like to call it disequilibrium, because it's got a lot of syllables in it. Right? But disequilibrium is important. And for me, that would be what I would say to people, is embrace the disequilibrium. Because as long as you are off balance, you are trying to find your way. And it's in trying to find your way that you come to a new place. Right? So maybe say something from your experience that has been helpful to you in finding where you are right now. And you guys think about a question to ask.
I will tell you, walking the Cretan Labyrinth has been a discipline that's really helped me, because it described exactly what it's like to wander through life and in your faith. You start on one side, you see what you're aiming for as truth, but it's this circuitous back and forth, and then you're back at the beginning, and you're like, what? And then you go back around again, but you're maybe on the outside. So you're simultaneously getting closer to the truth, and then sometimes you feel like you're farther away. And then you're back to the beginning, and then you're like, I thought I believed what these people believe, and now I could have swore I would never believe what these people. Now I'm over there. And so I found that walking that labyrinth, and honestly, during my search, I went to a rabbi, to a synagogue, and was asking him questions. I went and worshiped with Quakers when I was traveling. That was amazing. I've always felt like these disciplines are actually helping me find my faith again. So it used to be, don't do that, don't meditate, that's wrong, you need to pray. But I followed the Buddhist traditions, and I'm like, oh, surrender. That's kind of what we're supposed to do as Christians. I just never knew how. And the Buddhists were like, sit down, breathe, take a breath in, let go of everything. I'm like, oh my God, why won't Christians teach us this? We're told to surrender to God, but we don't know how. So, yeah, I would say meditating and walking that labyrinth has really helped me.
Beautiful.
I would add on to what Jarrell has said here, in that when you're in that
disequilibrium.
That disequilibrium place. And when you're a person who likes to be sure of things, I just kept saying to myself, God, and I'm using that in a very ethereal way, however you want to define it, is too big for one religion. So as I'm making these steps, these questions, it's like, it's okay to look at Buddhism because God is too big for Christianity. And it's okay to look at the Jewish faith and all these, and particularly the Muslim faith, because I've had quite a lot to do with it. I have a much better understanding of who God is, because I have looked at all these other faiths.
Well, when I was in high school, like the mid-40s, the Youth for Christ movement was big. And I'm in Lubbock, and some of the young student evangelists would come out from Baylor to preach to us. And then we would go to the smaller churches around and work with those young people. And I had gone out to Shallow Water when Sunday evening, and after the service, we sat in a prayer circle, and I had this fabulous light experience. The room was filled with light. I was filled with light. I felt this warmth, and I call it a Holy Spirit experience, but that was a major transformative experience for me, having experienced something that I had read about, and the change became a different approach to my belief system. Some major changes in my life have been from reading books. I read in high school. I read 3 books by Harry Emerson Fosdick. I still have one of them on being a real person, and of course, you can't read Fosdick without getting excited. There's something just precious about that. I read The Reach of the Mind by J.B. Ryan, and I was a science major in high school, and I thought of, and I still think of myself as a scientist, and I felt that Ryan's work was scientific evidence in support of that we are spiritual beings. Now, I know that a lot of people who read that don't see it that way, but to me it was affirming what I had felt. You know, the 82nd Psalm has always meant everything to me. You are God's children of the Most High, all of you. And when Jesus was accused, he says, doesn't your own law say you are God's? So the spiritual beingness of everyone, and when we're told to love our enemy, I think the way it works for me is this is a brother. This is a fellow God being. And it makes a difference from just saying they're bad and evil and we're good. Reading of this, reading books, especially about mysticism. I read about Tibetan mysticism and then Chinese mysticism, Secret of the Golden Flower, and a great book. What mysticism is about in practice is meditation. And that became a special study of mine. I took, you know, remember when the Maharishi was featured so much by the Beatles. And I actually took a Maharishi course. And, of course, the notion that when you do that course, you have to devote yourself to the guru, which is very distasteful for me. But the pursuit of meditation, one of the really great influences in my studies was Carl Jung, and he's the great psychologist, and he was interested in ESP and interested in mysticism, and his teachings about archetypes. I started as a psychologist getting really interested in the archetypal Bible, what, you know, like we are miniature replicas of the temple, of the tabernacle. The parts of the tabernacle, actually, Jung says an archetype is a pattern, and the Bible actually uses pattern to say the tabernacle is a pattern of what we are, and so I think the most important thing to me is the richness of addressing ourselves as children of the Most High.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.